Chapter 15. Dr. Carl Stefansson did not stop to wonder if he was a brave man. Never before in his life had he known the need for so primitive a virtue as physical courage, and he was agreeably surprised at his calmness now that the crisis had almost come. In a few hours he would probably be dead. The thought gave him more annoyance than fear. There was so much work he wanted to do, so many theories to be tested. It would be wonderful to get back to scientific research again, after the rat race of the last 2 years. But that was daydreaming. Mere survival was as much as he could hope for now. He opened his briefcase and pulled out the sheafs of wiring diagrams and component schedules. With some amusement, he noticed that Wheeler was staring with frank curiosity at the complex circuits and the secret labels plastered over them. Well, there was little need for security now, and Stefansson himself could not have made much sense of these circuits had he not invented them himself. He glanced again at the packing case to make sure that it was securely lashed down. There, in all probability, lay the future of more worlds than one. How many other men had ever been sent on a mission like this? Stefansson could think of but two examples, both back in the days of the Second World War. There had been a British scientist who had carried a small box across the Atlantic, containing what was later called the most valuable consignment ever to reach the shores of the United States. That had been the first cavity magnetron, the invention which made radar the key weapon of war and destroyed the power of Hitler. Then a few years later, there had been a plane flying across the Pacific to the island of Tinian, carrying almost all the free uranium-235 then in existence. But neither of those missions, for all their importance, had the urgency of this. Stefansson had exchanged only a few words of formal greeting with Jameson and Wheeler, expressing his thanks at their cooperation. He knew nothing about them, except that they were astronomers from the observatory who had volunteered to undertake this trip. Since they were scientists, they would certainly be curious to know what he was doing here, and he was not surprised when Jameson handed over the controls to his colleague and stepped down from the driving position. "It won't be so rough from now on," said Jameson. "We'll get to this Thor place in about 20 minutes. Is that good enough for you?" Stefansson nodded. "That's better than we'd hoped when that damn ship broke down. You'll probably get a special medal for this." "I'm not interested," said Jameson rather coldly. "All I want to do is what's right. Are you quite certain that you're doing the same?" Stefansson looked at him in surprise, but it took him only an instant to sum up the situation. He had met Jameson's type before among the younger men of his own staff. These idealists all went through the same mental heart searchings, and they would all grow out of it when they were older. He sometimes wondered if that was a tragedy or a blessing. "You are asking me," he said quietly, "to predict the future. No man can ever tell if, in the long run, his acts will lead to good or evil. But I'm working for the defense of Earth, and if there is an attack, it will come from the Federation, not from us. I think you should bear that in mind."
"Yet haven't we provoked it?"
"Perhaps so, but again, there is much to be said on both sides. You think of the Federals as starry-eyed pioneers, building wonderful new civilizations out there on the planets. You forget that they can be tough and unscrupulous, too. If they get what they want, they'll be intolerable. I'm afraid they've asked for a lesson, and we hope to give it to them. It's a pity it's come to this, but I see no alternative." He glanced at his watch, saw that it was nearly at the hour, and continued, "Do you mind switching on the news? I'd like to hear the latest developments." Jameson tuned in the set and rotated the antenna system toward Earth. There was a fair amount of noise from the solar background, for Earth was now almost in line with the sun, but the sheer power of the station made the message perfectly intelligible, and there was no trace of fading. Stefansson was surprised to see that the tractor chronograph was over a second fast. Then he realized that it was set for that oddly christened hybrid, Lunar Greenwich Time. The signal he was listening to had just bridged the 400,000-kilometer gulf from Earth. It was a chilling reminder of his remoteness from home. Then there was a delay so long that Jameson turned up the volume to check that the set was still operating. After a full minute, the announcer spoke, his voice striving desperately to be as impersonal as ever. "This is Earth calling. The following statement has been issued from The Hague. The Triplanetary Federation has informed the government of Earth that it intends to seize certain portions of the moon, and that any attempt to resist this action will be countered by force. This government is taking all necessary steps to preserve the integrity of the moon. A further announcement will be issued as soon as possible. For the present, it is emphasized that there is no immediate danger, as there are no hostile ships within 20 hours of Earth. This is Earth. Stand by." A sudden silence fell. Only the hiss of the carrier wave and the occasional crackle of solar static still issued from the speaker. Wheeler had brought the tractor to a halt so that he could hear the announcement. From his driving seat, he looked down at the little tableau in the cabin beneath him. Stefansson was staring at the circuit diagrams spread over the map table, but was obviously not seeing them. Jameson still stood with his hand on the volume control. He had not moved since the beginning of the announcement. Then, without a word, he climbed up into the driving cab and took over from Wheeler. To Stefansson, it seemed ages before Wheeler called to him,
"We're nearly there. Look, dead ahead."
He went to the forward observation port and stared across the cracked and broken ground. What a place to fight for, he thought. But of course, this barren wilderness of lava and meteor dust was only a disguise. Beneath it, nature had hidden treasures which men had taken 200 years to find. Perhaps it would have been better had they never found them at all. Still, 2 or 3 kilometers ahead, the great metal dome was glinting in the sunlight. From this angle, it had an astonishing appearance, for the segment in shadow was so dark as to be almost invisible. At first sight, indeed, it looked as if the dome had been bisected by some enormous knife. The whole place looked utterly deserted, but within, Stefansson knew, it would be a hive of furious activity. He prayed that his assistants had completed the wiring of the power and submodulator circuits. Stefansson began to adjust the helmet of his spacesuit, which he had not bothered to take off after entering the tractor. He stood behind Jameson, holding on to one of the storage racks to steady himself. "Now that we're here," he said, "the least I can do is to let you understand what's happened." He gestured toward the rapidly approaching dome. "This place started as a mine, and it still is. We've achieved something that's never been done before. Drilled a hole 100 kilometers deep right through the moon's crust and down into really rich deposits of metal."
100 kilometers? Cried Wheeler. "That's impossible. No hole could stay open under the pressure."
"It can and does," retorted Stefansson. "I've not time to discuss the technique, even if I knew much about it. But remember, you can drill a hole 6 times as deep on the moon as you can on Earth before it caves in. However, that's only part of the story. The real secret lies in what they've called pressure mining. As fast as it's sunk, the well is filled with a heavy silicone oil, the same density as the rocks around it. So no matter how far down you go, the pressure is the same inside as out, and there's no tendency for the hole to close. Like most simple ideas, it's taken a lot of skill to put it into practice. All the operating equipment has to work submerged under enormous pressure, but the problems are being overcome, and we believe we can get metals out in worthwhile quantities. The Federation learned this was going on about 2 years ago. We believe they tried the same thing, but without any luck. So they're determined that if they can't share this hoard, we won't have it either. Their policy seems to be one of bullying us into cooperation, and it's not going to work. That's the background, but now it's only the less important part of the story. There are weapons here as well. Some have been completed and tested. Others are waiting for the final adjustments. I'm bringing the key components for what may be the decisive one. That's why Earth may owe you a greater debt than it can ever pay. Don't interrupt. We're nearly there, and this is what I really want to tell you. The radio was not telling the truth about that 20 hours of safety. That's what the Federation wants us to believe, and we hope they go on thinking we've been fooled. But we've spotted their ships, and they're approaching 10 times as fast as anything that's ever moved through space before. I'm afraid they've got a fundamental new method of propulsion. I only hope it hasn't given them new weapons as well. We've not much more than 3 hours before they get here, assuming they don't step up their speed still further. You could stay, but for your own safety, I advise you to turn around and drive like hell back to the observatory. If anything starts to happen while you're still out in the open, get under cover as quickly as possible. Go down into a crevasse, anywhere you can find shelter, and stay there until it's all over. Now, goodbye and good luck. I hope we have a chance of meeting again when this business is finished. Still clutching his mysterious packing case, Stefansson disappeared into the airlock before either of the men could speak. They were now entering the shadows of the Great Dome, and Jameson circled it looking for an opening. Presently he recognized the spot through which he and Wheeler had made their entrance and brought Ferdinand to a halt. The outer door of the tractor slammed shut, and the airlock clear indicator flashed on. They saw Stefansson running across toward the dome, and with perfect timing a circular port flipped open to let him in, then snapped shut behind him. The tractor was alone in the building's enormous shadow. Nowhere else was there any sign of life, but suddenly the metal framework of the machine began to vibrate at a steadily rising frequency. The meters on the control panel wavered madly, the lights dimmed, and then it was all over. Everything was normal again, but some tremendous field of force had swept out from the dome and was even now expanding into space. It left the two men with an overwhelming impression of energies awaiting the signal for their release. They began to understand the urgency of Stefansson's warning. The whole deserted landscape seemed tense with expectation. Across the steeply curving plain, the tiny beetle of the tractor raced for the safety of the distant hills. But could they be sure of safety even there? Jameson doubted it. He remembered the weapons that science had made more than 2 centuries ago. They would be merely the foundation upon which the arts of war could build today. The silent land around him, now burning beneath the noonday sun, might soon be blasted by radiations fiercer still. He drove forward into the shadow of the tractor, toward the ramparts of Plato, towering along the skyline like some fortress of the giants. But the real fortress was behind him, preparing its unknown weapons for the ordeal that must come.